Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum Conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Lightning Strikes, a Successful Appeal in the Opioid MDL, and Whether We Will See More Interlocutory Appeals in MDLs. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Robert Keeling, who is a partner at Sidley Austin and co-chair of Sidley's e-discovery task force. We also have Tim Pratt, who is formerly general counsel at Boston Scientific. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will then go to an audience Q&A. Thank you both for sharing with us today, and Tim, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Michael. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining. Just a little bit of background on, you know, why in the world am I here talking to you about this? I've got some unique experience. I'm not saying it's entirely unique, but it's fairly unique, I think, because I spent 30 years at Sicardi & Bacon in Kansas City, and I was a national trial lawyer. I was involved in a number of MDLs, and I was the lead MDL counsel in the for the defendant in the single defendant guidant defibrillator litigation up in Minnesota. So I actually lived and breathed this for most of my career. And in 2008, I was hired away to become the general counsel and corporate secretary of Boston Scientific. So in my 10 years there, I was involved in MDLs as well, including one of the largest MDLs ever, which is a pelvic mesh MDL. So I've seen it from the standpoint of sort of the outside counsel, the advocate, as well as the invoice paying client in that setting. I've also been involved in some legal organizations. I spent 3 years on the board of DRI. I was past president of the Federation of Defense and Corporate Counsel. And I am, and maybe more importantly to the discussion, I'm a past president of Lawyers for Civil Justice, who's in the forefront of trying to get these rules changed to allow for interlocutory appeals. And before we get to, you know, the good news that Robert has to say about the success he had in the opioid litigation, I'd just like to address, you know, what's this hubbub all about? I mean, why do we care about interlocutory appeals in MDLs? And I'm going to talk to you about numbers a little bit, because things have really changed a lot in the over 50 years since Section 1407 was adopted and authorized the creation of multi-district litigation. That was back in 1968, and it was enacted because Congress sort of, you know, recognized an overwhelming burden on the federal courts that arose out of a single litigation in the electrical industry, antitrust cases. At that, just before that, there were 1,900 cases that were spread out over 36 districts. And that was a catastrophe, as some people said, that overwhelmed the federal court system. The end of September 2019, there were 134,000 cases pending in 194 MDLs. Not 1,900, not 19,000, 134,000 cases pending in 194 MDLs. That represents 46.7% of all pending federal civil cases. 46.7%. And it's, of course, as you, many of you know, that's dramatically increased. In 2002, MDL cases only constituted 16%. And now they're 46.7%. Most of these, though, even though they're 134,000, almost 122,000 of those are just in 22 of the 194 MDLs. And the final point that relates to the appellate review process, these MDL cases are not equally distributed across all of the circuits. For example, in the 10th Circuit, there are only six MDLs with a total of 95 cases, and it makes up only 1.4% of all cases in that circuit. In contrast, in the Fifth Circuit, there are 51,577 cases, in the NVL cases, and it makes up 71% of all civil cases there. Third Circuit has almost 30,000. That makes up 66% of its civil cases. So they're sort of unequally distributed, if you will, across the various circuits, with the Fifth and the Third getting actually most of them. So the problem is these things are growing, and they're growing fast. The problem is that defendants are beginning to get maybe a little more dismayed with the whole MDL process. You get trapped in it. The numbers are great. You have things like this cottage industry of you know, lead generators and advertisements and third-party litigation funding that's driving more and more numbers coming in. People file cases without really the merits being addressed. They're frivolous cases. There's no real vetting process to get rid of them. And you, once you're involved with it, all the, you know, the judge wants to sort of force settlement in many instances. So it's turned into, in the perception of some, almost a claims processing situation versus a merit determination situation. So that's the scenario. That's what we're dealing with MDLs, and why we're really starting to look at what we can do to allow for more timely and effective appellate review of what an MDL judge does. And you say, well, aren't there tools around? I mean, you can take a writ of mandamus. I mean, why not that? So, Robert, if you could talk a little bit about, is writ of mandamus a real effective way to allow for, you know, appellate oversight of what an MDL judge does on significant rulings?
Yeah, Tim, again, thanks for everyone else for having me and obviously talking with you here today, Tim, about a really important topic that, as you kind of laid out with the numbers, with the MDL proceedings, has a really outsized impact on federal litigation today. And you kind of pointed to some of the issues that are, you know, that we have with the numbers, and particularly the size and the proportion of the number of cases that are in MDL proceedings. And, you know, that means that the rulings of the MDL court on kind of pretrial discovery issues have, you know, that much greater of an effect, you know, on those cases. So as you're saying, if you have, you know, 95 cases in one circuit, and you get a discovery ruling that, you know, is problematic and maybe isn't what it should have been, well, that's one thing. But if you have 55,000 cases, like you mentioned in the Fifth Circuit, and you get, you know, obviously some of those cases are accounting for the bulk of those numbers, and if you have 10,000 cases and you get a negative discovery ruling that affects all 10,000, well, now your kind of exposure as a defendant is that much more, and really exponentially more. And the problem there is that your recourse is extremely limited, that parties tend not to file mandamus petitions when they get negative discovery rulings in many cases, because the likelihood of success is low. And on top of that, it's oftentimes, you know, creates issues with how the district court proceedings, you know, whether there's going to be a stay for the underlying discovery issue, and what is going to happen with the rest of the proceedings, and whether you, and obviously, you know, litigants are concerned about creating issues with that district judge. And so the problem is, you know, it takes a lot of time to hear the mandamus. They're rarely granted. And then many times the mandamus court will defer to the discretion of the district judge. And so all of that ends up meaning that, you know, mandamus is really now is an extraordinary remedy, as opposed to you know, effective appellate review of impactful discovery cases, and which is a problem because some of these discovery matters or discovery rulings really impact whether the case can go forward or not. If you have 10,000 plaintiffs and you get a very bad discovery ruling, well, that could be the difference between, you know, forcing, you know, having to settle as a corporate defendant on unfavorable terms or not. And so it can be case determinative, but the, you know, kind of underlying rules about how mandamus petitions are granted typically doesn't treat them as case determinative. And I don't know if that's been your experience as well, Tim, in your in either your practice or with LCJ or other organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Jerry, I'm sort of struck, Robert, by what the Supreme Court has said about mandamus and said it's only available in exceptional cases because it's disruptive to the judicial process and creates disorder and delay in the trial. And so some people in the audience, do you have anything else on writs of mandamus, Robert, before I talk about the other avenue?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So some of you may be, you know, you legal scholars may say, I don't know why you're fighting for this. There's already an interlocutory appeal provision in the federal, in the federal statutes. And it is, it's 1292B. And here's the problem with it. Actually, two problems with it in the MDL setting. Two components have to be satisfied for a 1292B interlocutory appeal is allowed. One, there has to be a substantial ground for difference of opinion. And two, that an immediate appeal from the order may materially advance the ultimate termination of the litigation. Those are the standards. And sometimes when you're dealing with, you know, a lot of even important motions, you know, someone may say those have not been met. Certainly the plaintiff's lawyers are going to argue that it has not been met. But the real serious underlying problem with it is the judge who has a veto power over whether those standards are met or not under 1292B is the MDL judge. Because 1292B only works if an MDL judge says these have been met, these two components, and the appellate court, I urge you to take this appeal. So as a result of all of that, and a lot of work has been done by John Beisner of Skadden Arps, really good work that's been submitted as part of the rulemaking process I'll talk about, on how 1292B is actually been rarely invoked, and when invoked, has been rarely granted by the MDL judge. And those of you who've handled MDLs understand there, you know, to go to your MDL judge and say, I think you're wrong on this, and I want you to allow this thing to go up on appeal. One, there's a futility aspect of that. The judge may well say, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm running this thing. The advancing the material advancing the termination of the litigation is for me to do a bunch of bellwether trials, and that's what I'm going to do, and you can take it up as part of the final judgment. And then you run the risk of irritation, too. A judge may go, you're trying to disrupt what I'm trying to do here. So there's some natural sort of, you know, impediments to going to an MDL judge and trying to get 1292B. So what you're stuck with in most instances is you try a case, you have post-trial motions, and then after all of those are decided, sometimes two and a half years into an MDL, then it goes up on appeal for the appellate court to decide whether all that this judge has done in connection with the trial and the pretrial rulings should be set aside or not, after significant expense, a lot of delay, and often after a lot of push towards settlement. So, you know, deciding the merits on appeal, you know, 3-4 years after the MDL starts is really not a very effective way to do it. So what parties do, and to the opioid litigation, you know, they look for opportunities when they see a plain error to deal with the judge, but file a writ of mandamus action and try to get the appellate court to come in and do something right, even though it's hard to get and may create some irritation. You know, some parties have done it to great success, and you have people like Robert who was involved in a major success before the Sixth Circuit. So if you could just tee that up a little bit and give some background and what happened, Robert, it'd be great.
Yeah, sure. So perhaps before I get to the Sixth Circuit case involving MDLs that Tim was referencing, it might be helpful to give some folks some background. I should start that I wasn't involved in the underlying litigation. My involvement was I filed an amicus petition to the Sixth Circuit on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States and the National Association of Chain Drug Stores in support of the mandamus petition. So kind of that said, to give a brief overview of the opioid MDL and kind of how we got here, the opioid MDL was formed when the MDL judicial panel consolidated, it was more than 2,000 pending lawsuits at the time, kind of related broadly to all parts of the opioid kind of manufacture and supply chain. Now, obviously, I should say that underlying the opioid lawsuits, I think everybody is familiar, is obviously a real health crisis with obviously hundreds of thousands of Americans, you know, becoming addicted to opioids over the past couple decades. And that issue has led to, and the severity of the epidemic has kind of prompted, among others, state and local governments to address the issue, not only through kind of legislation or executive actions, but also through court challenges. They filed around the country against opioid manufacturers, distributors, or other supply chain entities. So those suits were proceeding separately in state and federal courts around the country. They were then consolidated in the opioid MDL, and it was consolidated in the Northern District of Ohio before Judge Dan Polster. So, you know, I mentioned that kind of the defendants here included kind of all parts of the supply chain, and that includes kind of the manufacturers of the opioid-related medications, the large pharmacies, but also individual pain clinics or physicians and the like. So, you know, with so many plaintiffs and defendants, the claims, you know, vary significantly. But kind of broadly speaking, the plaintiffs allege that the companies or the defendants kind of took part in fueling the opioid crisis in exchange for revenue, basically, that the drug makers kind of overly aggressively marketed the opioids while kind of downplaying addiction risks, and then the distributors failed to detect or report suspicious orders. So, you know, these cases, similar to kind of like the tobacco litigation, the plaintiffs were seeking, you know, costs incurred from, expending result of their kind of this crisis, including costs for medical care, drug treatment, law enforcement, things like that. Obviously, the defendants maintain that the medications were highly regulated, monitored by federal officials. The pills were only distributed after a licensed physician wrote a prescription and the like. So the suit was kind of joined and proceeding on a lot of different fronts, including there were some bellwether cases that were set to be tried. The what we're kind of talking about, the Sixth Circuit opinion here, it relates to a writ of mandamus filed by the national retailers, including CVS, Rite Aid, Walgreens, Walmart, and the like. It arose out of cases filed by two Ohio counties, and it kind of related basically to three broad issues. So underlying this, the district court allowed these two counties to amend their complaint, like to allow like new claims based on new facts that would require new discovery, and allowed it, you know, months and months after the deadline for amendment had passed. The court then overruled the defendant's objections, including that this should be allowed, basically saying that, you know, the arguments would be kind of better taken in the context of a single case, but how those objections lose their import in the context of an MDL. So, and the court said, basically, we're going to get to this discovery, you know, anyway, and these claims eventually, so might as well do it now. And similarly, along that lines, the court did not allow or refused to entertain, I should say, the defendants from filing a 12B a motion to dismiss. And also, in discovery, then, the court ordered the production of state, regional, and nationwide prescription information, even though the underlying dispute related to just two counties. So, basically requiring data on every prescription sold by pharmacies around the country over, I think it was a period of about 20 years. So the pharmacies sought mandamus and argued that not only was it overbroad, but it didn't take into account, you know, the protecting the personal and sensitive pharmacy and private information kind of at issue. So basically underlying the mandamus petition was the argument that the federal rules of civil procedure apply to MDL proceedings, you know, that there's nothing so special about MDLs that different rules should apply, and that, you know, MDL courts shouldn't be allowed to kind of make up procedures on an ad hoc basis, which isn't in essence what the district court was, you know, doing here. So there were a lot of several amicus filed as part of this. As I mentioned, you know, we represented chambers when our focus was on kind of Rule 26 and proportionality in the context of MDLs, and basically urging the Sixth Circuit to apply the proportionality requirements in kind of all aspects of federal litigation, including MDLs. LCJ also filed an amicus in support. Their argument focused kind of on the point that MDL courts are kind of bound generally by the federal rules, and there was no kind of MDL exception. Somewhat unusually, we were joined by the ACLU, who filed their own brief, kind of focusing on the serious privacy concerns raised by the district court's discovery order, and basically saying the order would violate those patients or implicates their rights under the Due Process Clause in the Fourth Amendment. So again, despite that, as we're talking about, the deck is kind of stacked against the defendants here about granting the petition. But somewhat surprisingly, the Sixth Circuit took up the mandamus petition and sustained it in large measure. Basically, it allowed prescription level data for the state of Ohio, but otherwise sustained all of defendants' arguments. And I think it's important for a number of reasons. One, not just it was a successful mandamus petition in the context of an MDL, which in of itself would be important and unusual. But I think it's also important for the language that was used. So the court had a lot of strong language, including, you know, it started right off the bat saying that the, I think I have it here, quote, the rule of law applies in multi-district litigation just as it does in any individual case. So basically the court found that, you know, every case in an MDL retains its individual character, which I think, you know, should have been a common sense proposition, but it's really important, I think, to hear from an appellate court. And, you know, a lot of what the court then said flowed from that premise. You know, it ruled that an MDL's court determination of the party's rights in an individual case must be based on the same kind of legal rules that apply in other cases. And then, of course, it also held that an MDL court, you know, it has broad discretion to create efficiencies, but it can't disregard rules and the federal rules in the name of those efficiencies. And so, which I think is particularly, you know, important that that the Sixth Circuit found, again, just looking at this, that, quote, an MDL court must find efficiencies within the civil rules rather than violation of them. So, in other words, like the name of efficiencies can't get a court around the federal rules. And then it also held that, you know, the requirements for MDLs are not only the same as ordinary litigation, but kind of your final colorful quote, it said, quote, but MDLs are not some kind of judicial border country where the rules are few and the law rarely makes an appearance. End quote. So that was a particularly good one. Instead, basically MDLs retain kind of the individual cases retain their separate identities. So it held that the amendment allowing the amendment claims were abuse of discretion and should not have been allowed. And because of that, it held kind of the other points, including the proportionality analysis, were moot. But still, I think it's a really important ruling, and in particular, kind of really, really important language that might flow from it. I don't know, Tim, if you have kind of any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that Dummy is a great opinion, and congratulations on for you and everybody involved with it. I think there's a little bit of risk that people go, there you go. Now we've got we've got some control and review of MDO judges, and so what's everybody worried about? And I think that, you know, this was maybe the exceptional case. And what we've been trying to do is to not make appellate review an exception. It's to make it more timely and more readily available to the litigant, Robert.
Yeah, exactly right. And that is the challenge. I completely agree that one opinion does not make a trend. I think it's important and informative to MDL proceedings around the country. But it's really the structural issue of, as you said, interlocutory appeals or mandamus issues. It creates a lot of hurdles for correcting decisions that just, you know, went too far in an individual MDL proceeding.
Right, exactly. So I thought I would spend a little bit of time talking to you about, you know, given that we believe, a lot of people believe that MDL judges, their rulings should have a more timely and effective appellate review, what's been going on in that front. And there are a number of, you know, great organizations involved in civil justice reform. You know, Institute for Legal Reform, which is part of the Chambers, is one phenomenal group, and they do good work. But Lawyers for Civil Justice really focuses on, you know, the rules of civil procedure, the federal rules of civil procedure. I want to spend just a second kind of letting you know what's involved in changing the rules. And I'll do this, you know, quickly, because it's a long, difficult, tortuous process, if you will. The Judicial Conference of the United States Courts is really the ultimate group in charge of, like, changing the rules of civil procedure. And the Judicial Conference has created what's called a standing committee, and it's made up of five advisory rules committees. There's bankruptcy, there's appellate, I'm not going to get them all, there's civil. But the one I want to talk about is the advisory committee on civil rules, because that's the one that really has the authority to look at the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and make changes. That committee is made up of, you know, roughly 15 members. They have a chair, they got a reporter, got a lot of federal judges, both appellate court and district court judges. They have some practitioners, generally a couple on each side of the bar, if you will. And they sit there and are presented with proposals. They evaluate those proposals. If they see a need for a change, they'll make a recommendation to the standing committee for the rule to be changed. That will open up public comment, you know, written commentary, and that process goes on for quite a while, where you actually testify in front of the Civil Rules Advisory Committee. They take that information, and if they still agree that a change should be made, they make the recommendation to the standing committee. The standing committee, if they agree, make the recommendation to the Judicial Conference. The Judicial Conference will then send it to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court will then, if they agree, send it to Congress. And thank God, it's one of these examples where for Congress to tinker with that, they have to stop the process. It's not that you need approval from Congress. Their authority is simply to mustering up opposition to it, that they would say, we're not going to allow the change, which really doesn't happen, given all the work that goes into these changes. So back some years ago, I mean, way back in 2017, you know, LCJ saw that, you know, there was a problem with MDLs, but actually lots of problems. And I cited some data, by the way, early on in this teleform, to those of you who, you know, wrote all those things down can now regret it, because you can get all of that data in a website that LCJ created called Rules 4. It's a number 4, rules4mdls.com. A lot of good information there on infographics and things like that that would be helpful to you. So back in 2017, LCJ made a proposal to the Civil Rules Advisory Committee to make many changes in MDLs, you know, changes in the vetting of cases before they're filed or shortly after they're filed, changes in the bellwether process, a proposal to require disclosure of third-party litigation funding in connection with the litigation, and a request that allow for more ready interlocutory appeals under appropriate circumstances. So that was in August of 2017. In November 2017, The Silver Rules Advisory Committee created a subcommittee that was going to focus on MDLs. That subcommittee is still active and involved. There were a number of submissions by LCJ as well as plaintiffs, the plaintiffs bar. They're very involved in this process as well. Like I said, it's a real battle. I mean, LCJ made another proposal in April of 2018. There was a meeting of the civil of the MDL subcommittee with LCJ representatives back in September of 2018. More information was provided in October of 2019. The MDL subcommittee sat down with representatives of the defense side and the plaintiff side to kind of have an open debate, oral argument on what changes ought to be made. These are really, I mean, it's like an oral argument that goes on for like 4 hours. So you can imagine it. So again, you know, in March of this year, LCJ even filed another proposal to address the three things that this MDL subcommittee said that they're really looking into. Third-party litigation funding isn't on the forefront of that, though we haven't given up on that. Change the bellwether process isn't on it, but we haven't given up on it. It's the three areas. The three areas are the early vetting of claims that are filed, number one. Number two, interlocutory appeal, made the cut. And then one that really not many people talked about, it dealt with judicial oversight of settlement of MDL cases, as in class actions. That's new. I'm not sure where it's going to go. LCJ has really raised questions about whether anything like that's necessary. I really think there's no need for something like that. But we'll see where that goes. You know, I submitted an op-ed to Law 360 in April of this year. Plaintiffs responded. You know, data has been generated. I mentioned John Beisner. The plaintiffs have come up with their own, quote, data, close quote, to try to convince the Civil Rules Advisory Committee that no change should be made, that everything's just fine the way it is. So I want to just take a moment to let you know kind of where things stand right now. And in doing this, I thought the most effective way to do it was to present what the plaintiff said on a point, what the LCJ has said on that point, and where I see the committee leaning. And if there's a committee member here, I'm not being presumptuous. I'm not a prognosticator. I'm not on the committee, so I could be completely wrong on it. But I thought it would be helpful, you know, for me to kind of distill for this group where I think the committee might be leaning at the present time. And it all can change because they're still gathering data. One thing the plaintiffs say is that defendants aren't using the tools that are available to them right now. They're not filing writs of mandamus. They're not using 1292B. As I mentioned, one reason defendants aren't doing that is because the standards are too high. There's a lot of futility and the risk of irritating your MDL judge. So that's really not an effective way to, you know, mandamus 1292B to do it. And the final judgment rule isn't working because of the delay. I think the committee sees there's, you know, that it's a little bit, you know, maybe something needs to be done. They see the problems. They've seen MDLs. We presented data on how long it takes for, you know, a case to get heard. You have bellwether trials, and it takes another year and a half before the MDL judge decides the post-trial motions. And then it goes up on appeal. So it's basically 4 to 5 years into it before you get any appellate review of the merits. And no matter what people say, merits really ought to count when you're involved in MDL litigation or indeed any litigation. So that's the first issue. Plaintiffs have repeatedly said that you can't have interlocutory appeal in MDLs because it'll just cause delay. It takes 2 years for cases to wind through the appellate courts to get an opinion. It's going to allow state litigation to overrun MDL litigation. And this is just crazy. We can't have these kinds of delays. What we say is, you know, if you have a bookend from the beginning of an MDL to the end of an MDL, there's always going to be, you know, some appellate time built into that. So instead of waiting for that appellate time to be at the very end, after all the pressure put on the defendant, move it up earlier. So there may be some delay associated with it than if you wait until the final judgment rule comes into a play. But it's important that you do it earlier rather than later. And whether you do 2 years from years 1 to 3 or 2 years from years 4 to 6 doesn't really make much difference in terms of delaying the ultimate outcome of the MDL. So, and what the plaintiffs also say is you can't have things just stop while the case is up on appeal. You know, if an MDL just, paralyzed for 2 years while it's up on appeal, what we've said as defendants is that, well, that makes, you know, that didn't make sense because we're not saying you have to stay proceedings at the MDL while the case is up on appeal. You can still do some things. You can do discovery, but you don't have to stop everything. And I think the committee is sort of, you know, they're still bothered by the delay issue. I think the Sixth Circuit opinion maybe highlights for them the importance of an appellate court getting involved sooner rather than later. I think they understand that it's a little bit unfair to defendants for them not to really get an appellate determination on the merits, until 4 years into an MDL. And I don't think there's any traction on the committee for an automatic stay while the case is on appeal. I think their view is it's going to be up to the district court and the appellate court to figure out what can be done if they allow interlocutory appeal in the middle of it. So the plaintiffs also say, well, the defendants are going to use this for delay and disruption. Every single ruling of the MDL judge, they're going to try to take an interlocutory appeal. Now, we haven't said that as LCJ. We agree that the rulings that go up on interlocutory appeal are those that are significant and dispositive of a great number of cases. You may be dealing with preemption, Daubert, general causation, a number of sort of fear claims, and whether those maybe 60% of the litigation, whether they can proceed. So we agree it has to be really important, and it has to be rather dispositive of a great number of cases. I think the committee clearly believes that they're not going to allow for routine review of MDL rulings. I mean, but I think where they are is how do you define which go up and which go down? The other argument plaintiffs make is that this is going to overwhelm the appellate court system. You know, but interestingly, when you read tea leaves, I think the appellate courts would actually like to be involved maybe a little earlier in some of these significant MDLs, and particularly on the potentially dispositive rulings. You can certainly shorten an MDL if you can. And by the way, I think everybody agrees that it's not, you know, a mandatory appeal to the appellate court. I think most people believe that it's permissive for the appellate court. You make an application to the appellate court, who then will decide whether this is the kind of case that should be taken up or not. And I think it's pretty clear that the committee is leaning toward the permissive nature of that, not mandatory, and leaving it to the appellate court to decide kind of, you know, how much of these things they would accept. There was those of you involved in class actions may remember 23F, which allowed for the appeal of cases that are either class certifications that are either granted or denied. And people say, that's crazy. You're going to deny a class. They're going to go up on appeal, and it's going to be crazy and disruptive and going to paralyze the lower court. And then the evidence is that's not happened at all under 23F. So that's the kind of thing that we're arguing will likely happen here. And MDL judges, you know, still have a lot of control over things. So there was I believe as in 1292B, they should not. We don't want to have that mechanism where they have a right to veto it. But I think the committee would like to hear from MDL judges, and I think they may be thinking about the appellate court in deciding whether to take a case might want to solicit the input from the MDL judge on whether the appellate court ought to take it or not. So won't be completely knocked out of it. The other challenge, I think the final thing that we have is that, and this is what the committee is sort of trying to deal with as well, is that, as I said in the statistics, you know, only a few MDLs have most of the cases. So the plaintiffs say, well, why are you creating a rule for all MDLs when most MDLs, the smaller ones, you know, they don't have these problems. You know, they're faster to conclusion and fewer number of parties, fewer number of issues, and you don't really hear these people screaming that change ought to be made. And that may be the case because the biggest complaint that you see are in these mass tort cases, the big ones that have most of the cases. So the, what the committee is looking at, and you know, we've sort of said, you know, LCJ and one of these meetings with the subcommittee, you know, it should apply to everybody. All MDLs, because even in a small MDL, there might be, it may be important to get early appellate review through an interlocutory avenue rather than not. And I think the committee is trying to wrestle with, do you do it to all of them, or do you really try to define, you know, a size or complexity that would allow them to be used in some cases and not in others? And, you know, we sort of make the point and argument about the problem that, you know, there's an argument here that it's really an unbalanced process for defendants because, you know, we get hit with discovery, we get hit with the bellwether cases, and we have to wait till final judgment after it's over if we lose the pretrial motions. If the plaintiff lose the pretrial motions, they can go up on appeal immediately. So the point we made is just an element of fairness that, you know, if they can go up, a la 23F, then why shouldn't the defendant be allowed to go up? So I think, you know, there's a lot going on. I think there are a lot of people involved in this. LCJs is at the forefront, but ILR and all these other organizations and defense, you know, DRI, FTCC, IADC, all of them are involved in trying to, you know, bring some needed change to this and allow for interlocutory appeal of some significant issues in a timely fashion. And I think that's kind of where we are right now. I don't know, Robert, I've been going on a while. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this before we perhaps open it up to some questions.
No, I think one, the LCJ's work here has really been great and really trying to advance the law here and make some good needed reforms. But personally, I think the difference on kind of allowing having this be permissive review rather than mandatory review is an important one, and I think really meets the counter arguments here about on these points. And then I think if there was, you know, kind of sufficient permissive review, you would get, you know, within just a matter of a couple of years, some good body of case law on these discovery issues in the MDL context, which then could provide guidance to the litigants going forward, and which really you don't have right now. You're basing a lot of the decisions or how the litigation progresses based off of you know, rulings by special masters or, you know, magistrate or district courts, and to have the views of the appellate courts here more often, I think, could only help, you know, how MDL litigation proceeds.
Yeah, Michael, before I turn over to questions, you can kind of start that process. I wanted to make one other comment on this, and that is, as part of this rulemaking change, you know, I told you the plaintiff's lawyers are opposed to really any change in this regard. They like the system as it is, and I understand that. But the other group that tends to be a little resistant to this are, as you might expect, MDL judges, because, you know, they have an important job to do, and they've got to, you know, they think they need to, and rightfully so, they need to have the tools to be able to do it, and that this sort of appellate oversight at a point when they may not think it's important would maybe detrimental to their management of MDL. So I think, you know, not to overstate, I think, you know, there are a number of MDL judges who don't support a rule change. I think there are a number of appellate courts are kind of, you know, back and forth between the two of them. I think some of them would like to be involved. So you've got a lot of dynamics here that you have to manage. And this subcommittee, eventually the Civil Rules Advisory Committee, will be the one to take a look at you know, based on all this data, should we make a change? And if so, what's that change look like? And then it opens up for comment, and then it all goes again. And you know, hope everybody here will join the queue and testify before the Civil Rules Advisory Committee to support any rule change. And so it's a process that will take a long time yet to come, and it's already taken quite a bit of time since 2017. Michael, you want to open up a Q&A?
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and open up the floor for some audience questions. We have a few questions lined up, so we'll move to our first question.
Hello, this is Brian Fitzpatrick at Vanderbilt Law School. Just wanted to thank you both for doing this. It's a very important issue. I agree with you, Tim, that the district judges that are given these MDLs are not going to like more interlocutory appeals, and I don't think we have to be romantic about it. I think we can be realistic about it. MDL judges are the most powerful judges in America. Forget your Supreme Court justices. These judges single-handedly have entire industries in the palms of their hands, and they don't want to lose that power. And so they are not going to like this idea, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't happen. I think we have given these judges way too much undiluted power, and something has to be done to provide some checks and some balances before they bankrupt an entire industry with some of their rulings. Now, in my discussions with the people on the subcommittee looking into this, the biggest sticking point that I feel they are wrestling with is how to define what orders are allowed to use this interlocutory appeal that they might confer in MDL cases. And you alluded to this problem a bit in some of your discussion, Tim, but rather than try to define when you can take an interlocutory appeal by referencing, say, a preemption order or a Daubert order, it's always going to be under-inclusive. There's always going to be something you miss if you try to specify it all in advance. I have advocated for simply giving each side one appeal and one interlocutory appeal, and they can decide when they want to take it. So we don't have to specify in advance. We can just let each side decide for themselves when they want to take something up. And we can debate whether we want to let you appeal everything else that's happened before that order. So you might want to wait until, late to take your one appeal, or we can have a rule that just lets you appeal one order and not the things that have come before it. I mean, we can debate which form this idea can take, but I like just leaving it to the parties to decide for themselves in one form or another when to invoke this. And I kind of analogize it to, pro football. We let the head coaches throw the flag when they want the replay. And I think it works better because they know best of when something's important. And I think the same is true of litigants in the MDL. What do you guys think of a rule that does not specify what types of orders, but leaves it to the parties to decide when to take one?
Excellent points, Brian. I agree. That's one of the real challenges the committee has. And, I'm in favor of, that's an interesting proposal you make. I'm also in favor of kind of keeping it a bit discretionary because we have to look at it in the context of what happened in the Sixth Circuit. So what standard of interlocutory appeal would had to have been in the rules for, Robert to be in a position to file an amicus in support of that? It wasn't all the parties. It was, so it's kind of interesting, but I agree with that. That's one of the big challenges the subcommittee's having.
Yeah. So for what it's worth, I think it's a great idea, Brian, and you're right that it's hard to set these out ahead of time because, as you mentioned, the example of Daubert, some Daubert motions are for experts that are nice to have, and some are for experts that are need to have. And so it, just allowing them across the board, I could see where, plaintiffs would have issues with that. As a litigant, I guess I would prefer, three challenges, like the pro football coaches that you alluded to. One is definitely, it gets into a lot of gamesmanship about when to invoke it if you just have one. But whatever the number is, it's kind of beside the point. I think the central point is that I agree with your concept that giving the litigants that decision over this is probably more efficient practically than trying to set out every possible area like ahead of time about where those appeals could be taken.
In the meantime, there are no other questions in the queue as of now. And in the meantime, I'll toss it back to our panel to see if there's anything else you wanted to cover before we close today.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would say in closing is that, you know, for you know, like I said, there are a lot of great organizations involved in seeking, you know, rule changes at the state court level, the federal court level, Congress. And I've just been, you know, privileged to be a part of that process for a long time, even when I was working at Sicardi and Bacon and as a member of LCJ, where there's a real satisfaction of being a part of a process that results in important, you know, rule changes. It's a hard, as I mentioned, and tortuous process, but it's one that's really satisfying. And I just urge, you know, the lawyers on this call, you know, look for an opportunity to get involved, because you can make a difference for, you know, the system, for the parties yet to come, for your clients. Clients like this, by the way, speaking as a general counsel. Let me repeat that. Clients like to see their lawyers out there involved in trying to level the playing field and making it better. So certainly on this issue, which is evolving, you know, your input would be great, but look for an opportunity to use your voice, speak up, join organizations, do things that really allow you to get out of the office and not bill hours, but really do something that's maybe more fulfilling and satisfying than winning the case.
Yeah, just for me, I completely agree with that, Tim. And, you know, I think the point here is that I don't know if anybody thinks that our current MDL system is perfect. Not even the most strident plaintiff would believe that. And so there is a significant room for improvement here. I think for what Tim is saying, I think the more folks who get involved with trying to improve this and other aspects of the federal rules, I think, you know, the better off that we all are.
All right. Not seeing any other questions in the queue. I'll assume that question was answered previously, and I'll go ahead and close this out for today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank both of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you to all for joining us, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.